represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And it was a big week for Microsoft.
Yeah.
Steve Ballmer announced that he is retiring.
And the stock went up.
Get this. Steve Ballmer owns enough stock in Microsoft that when he announced his retirement, he was $1 billion cheaper because of the stock bump. So he can buy himself a nice... But he's not leaving for another 12 months.
You will go in depth as to why and what all this means, right?
I plan to do that quite a bit. And I'm going to... I just ran across this website this week, Just Delete Me. And it's a way just to sort of take yourself off of all of these social media sites. You know, there is something that happens. You know, you start creep up with Facebook and then LinkedIn and then Twitter. Then pretty soon you're just an email. Pretty soon you're never able to unplug and just relax. And so some people just want to retire from the web, and this is a way to do that. I'm going to feature this week the guy who developed the Raspberry Pi,
and not the kind you're thinking of.
No, the Raspberry Pi. That would be PI. Which is the circumference divided by the diameter of a circle, that kind of pi.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a low-cost computer so people could learn about computers and play around with them. It's a great tool, and I suggest it's a great gift if you want to get your kids or your grandkids interested in technology. And, of course, it was a huge mailbag.
Even in the middle of summertime.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Here, Mr. Big Voice, help me get this up.
It's against union rules. You have to do it yourself.
That's why he doesn't do anything
that's
around
right.
here.
That's right. Very restrictive.
He won't even get me a cup of coffee.
No, he doesn't care. He just says his thing, gets his check, and goes away.
I don't know. Something's wrong with that.
There's definitely something.
Something's wrong with that. I'm going to have to file a union complaint or something.
I don't think they're going to help you out.
Okay, we got an email from Knock in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this is the group in Ohio that, of course, has got all these issues
with pictures.
Dear Tech Doc, I own a laptop, and I'm currently using it with... And one external monitor and the laptop monitor, because I got so many pictures to look at. Can I add a second external monitor so I can have all three monitors working at the same time?
Holy cow. What is she up to?
How many pictures do you have to look at? I mean, this must be, you're going to have three pictures side by side. You must have a real picture operating system up there. Now, you're using Windows 7, your home premium edition. It's 64 bits with 8 gigabytes of memory, and you'd like to know how to do this. Well, you've got to use your additional video outputs if you have them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for example, my Sony Vaio has got a composite video output, and it also has an HDMI output, so I could plug two monitors in quite easily. Quite frankly, I haven't seen the point to it, but I probably don't have as many pictures as they have up there in Ohio.
No, apparently not.
Now, but in your case, you apparently don't have that extra video plug. That's why you're asking the question. So there, you do have a couple of options. One option is to get a USB to DVI video converter, and you can get that for, less than $20. And then you plug that USB to DVI video device into your computer, and then you'd plug the monitor into the DVI port on the device. Now this actually would work fairly well for pictures, but if you got a lot of video, it's not going to work too well because the USB port isn't really fast enough to transfer video at high rates.
Okay.
So there would be kind of a lag in the video, or if you're playing a game, a lag. But if you're just looking at pictures, that would be a very good option, USB to DVI. Or if you're just using it for Word documents. Now, You could do what I did, plug it into the HDMI port, and then that would be no problem at all. I think that's probably your only option is using the, because there's really no other USB ports there. But that was a great question. I think you should be able to quite easily get your third monitor up there. And by the way, the Windows 7, if you put three monitors in, it's going to support three monitors automatically. So you don't need any kind of software fixes. It will detect three monitors, and you'll be able to use it quite well. So there's a good software interface that's already in your laptop. We got an email from Jim in Michigan. Dear Tech Talk, my son only responds to text messages. He does not like to answer the phone. I have an old cell phone that can't send text messages. You've got other... Yeah, that's pathetic, Jim.
I think he's saying something here, the son.
Yeah, is there...
I don't want to talk to you, Dad.
Is there a way to send text messages from my computer? Thanks, love the show, Jim in Michigan. Jim, if you've got such an old cell phone, it must be look like a brick. I mean, if it doesn't send text messages... Listen, I highly recommend that you do an upgrade. But it could be that you just love your old cell phone.
It could.
I have known people. In fact, I knew one guy by the name of Jim. He had this old flip phone, and he was so proud of his old phone, and it couldn't do anything. Until one day somebody talked him into getting an iPhone. Now he wonders why he's waited so long.
Are you talking about me?
No, I'm not. Yeah.
Okay. Because, before I had this, I had a slide phone. It wasn't exactly
a flip phone.
But I swear by this thing.
Yeah, you've become a real convert.
Yeah.
Well, Jim, you can send text messages from your computer. It's actually quite easy. All you need to know is the email address of the gateway, of the SMS gateway. And every of the vendors actually has an SMS gateway. You send an email to that gateway, and it will then be converted to a text message and sent to the to the phone of your choice. Now, remember, the gateway, the SMS message can only be 140 characters, and that includes the subject line. So don't put a subject line on there; it's just wasted. Mm-hmm. Just write in the text in your email message 140 characters. If you send more than 140 characters, it will be truncated. And that's just the first 140 characters will go.
I hate when it gets truncated.
A truncated text message is not good.
No.
That's why I like to use iMessage. It can be longer than 140 characters on the iPhone.
Really?
Yeah, the iMessage it's not using the text message format.
And you can do that on a computer. Or do you have to do it on your iPhone?
No, you have to do that on your iPhone. So now
that doesn't do Jim any good then.
It doesn't do Jim.
He needs to get an actual cell
phone.
No.
I was giving that piece of information for Jim here in the studio.
Oh, okay.
It was for another Jim.
Oh. There's too many Jims.
Too many Jims. Jim is such a common name,
Mm-hmm.
Well, but it's based on James, one of the apostles, so it's got to be all good.
Or something.
So here's the deal: if they have, you have to know what carrier his cell phone is. So you'll have to ask him. And if he decides to tell you, because there could be a communication here.
It sounds like there could be a problem.
There could be a communication here problem, Jim, that has nothing to do with technology. So so if he's got an AT&T carrier, you email to his phone number at txt.att.net. So it would be, say, 800-555-1212 at text.att.net, and that will then go directly to that phone number. Or if it's a Verizon phone, you would do the phone number, all no area code, no country code, just the area code and the number at vtext.com. That would be for Verizon. If it's T-Mobile, you would do the number at tmomail.net. If it is Sprint, you do the number at messaging.sprintpcs.com. Now, there's a complete list in Wikipedia, so I've just given you a few of them. Actually, every phone carrier has an SMS gateway.
Mm-hmm.
So you simply Google. The best way to do this is Google list of SMS gateways space Wikipedia. It'll take you right to the page, and you'll see the list of about 30 or 40 of them.
Interesting.
But that is quite convenient, though, if you've got to text somebody, you don't have your phone.
Can I have a sidebar
yes.
for a second? All right. So if you have an iPad that's that they basically have assigned to them a phone number, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I can text people via my iPad using my email address, right? So other people that have iPads or iDevices, an Apple device, mm-hmm. you can send them a text via your iPad. Why can't you do that to anybody else with another device?
Well, but you're not sending a text message. You're sending an iMessage.
Oh, so I am unwittingly using iMessage,
and you're only doing it, and you're only doing it to other iPhones.
Ah, okay.
Are you doing it to anything other than another iPhone?
Either an iPhone or an iPad.
That's an iMessage.
Okay.
That's not a text message.
So I can't text other people from the iPad.
Mm-mm, you don't. That's all. All you get is data. That's a good question. I don't know, because it is assigned a phone number. You can't make a phone call.
No,
with
you
it.
Can't.
And the
but you can do FaceTime through it, which I've never done.
You can do FaceTime, which is on the data side,
mm-hmm.
and the text messaging is a data field, which is within the voice bandwidth. And so I don't know. That is a very good question, and it may I'll check on that.
Okay,
I don't really know, but I have never successfully sent a text message with my iPad. I've sent a lot of iMessages, but mm-hmm. but no text messages. So I'll check on that, because the text message, even if you don't have data turned on, you can do text messaging, because there is a data field which is available for out of band communication in your voice channel, and it was used for network maintenance and other things, and they ended up using that for text messaging. And that particular data field is limited to, you know, the 140 characters.
Right.
And that's a different. So you can sign up for voice and you get text messaging data and not have data. So the data mm-hmm. you're doing FaceTime on is this other data service you've signed up for. And since you don't have voice, you may not have that 140 character data field.
I seem to be able to send really long texts.
Yeah.
But
I'm going to check on that, because maybe you could send a text message, and I just have never looked into it. But
I like doing it via the iPad, because I'm old and the screen's bigger and the keys are bigger.
Yeah.
It's a lot easier to send a text that way, but that's just me.
What you know what I do?
What's that?
I use the voice recognition. I don't even use. I just.
So you just talk into your iPad?
Yeah.
And it.
Why do you type it? That's so old school, Jim.
Look, I've gotten this far.
Jim,
okay?
Come on. You got voice recognition.
Interesting.
You just you just say send text to. You give the name. It's in there, and then you just can speak it.
Well, that's going to be the next thing.
So, you know, get with it. This is tech talk, Jim.
Okay. I'm trying, Doc. I really am.
But
did
listen,
you ever think
Jim,
I would...
Jim, the second word of our show, what is it?
Talk.
Exactly. It's not
hey, Doc.
It's not tech type.
It's not a show. It's a classroom of the airwaves.
It's classroom of the airwaves, of course. We got an email from Bernie in Manassas. Dear Tech Talk, I just bought a camera that allows me to take photographs in JPEG or JPEG plus RAW or just RAW.
Okay.
Okay, if I take a picture in RAW. Now this is not in the RAW. This is in RAW. You understand this?
Yeah. I get it.
The resulting picture is big. 24 megabytes.
Mm-hmm. Your iPhone's ringing.
Yeah. Yeah, my iPhone is buzzing. I better put it in my pocket so it doesn't buzz too loud in the studio. Check the stream. I think I'm getting a text message that our stream is not on.
Okay, let me work on that right now. You keep talking and I'll
so
check.
So if that's 24 megabytes, if you did it in the RAW, if I save it as a JPEG, it's 8 megabytes. If I save it as a TIFF, it's 45 megabytes. What format should I use? And what does it have to do with resolution? Thanks, Bernie and Manassas. Well, pixels and resolution are independent of file formats. Pixels, resolution, height by width, color depth. That actually applies pretty much to all the pictures. You can then store the information in different file formats. The RAW image file format is this. Each camera has its own RAW output, the way it natively stores data. RAW format is not a standardized format. You need to have special software for your particular camera to manipulate the raw data. This is the most accurate representation of the image data before any manipulation. I, for instance, had a scuba diver friend that would save all of his images in RAW and then perform color correction after the dive. What he would do, he would take a whiteboard with him when he was doing it, and he would then take a picture of the whiteboard at
white
a particular
balance it?
To white balance it, and uh-huh. then he would white balance the raw picture at, you know, after the dive, and that's a very good, because that's where color correction is important, especially when you're scuba diving. But by the time you get down to, say, you know, 50, 60 feet, it's kind of, you know, you lose the color, because the color is filtered out, and it sort of looks like, you know, gray images. When you get down to 90 feet, there's almost no color.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know, this color correction is really quite important for scuba diving. So many photographers, professional photographers, like to save their photographs in the RAW. Now, JPEG is what they call a lossy compression technique. It's not lossless. So what they do is they've made some trade-offs on what they can give up in terms of edge quality,
mm-hmm.
because it's usually the edges that create the most are the most difficult to store. And so if you shrink it down, your edge quality goes down. And so you make some trade-offs. And then when you store it in JPEG, you basically say, I want a high, I want a high quality image, or I want a low quality image. And by selecting the amount of loss you're able to you'll accept, you can get different sizes. But compressing this to an eight megabyte file, it's still a fairly good image, but it's not as good as, of course, the raw image, which is 24 megabytes. But the problem with the raw, you need this special software to manipulate it, whereas JPEG is a standard format to convert. So if you want to upload it to, say, Facebook, you're going to need to do it in JPEG. So I think many photographers store it in both. They store both, and then if they find that beautiful photo that's just of the most fantastic sunrise, they'll take that raw data, because that's it, and they'll pull it out, and then they will do their image manipulation using the special software, and then they'll get some high-quality print. But for most uses, they just, you know, use the JPEG if they want to do it for Facebook or whatever.
I kind of have this feeling when I take pictures of things that you've got one chance. You might as well save whatever you've got and then throw it, whatever you don't want, away later, right?
Throw it away, yeah. But it's a lot of work. I have one friend who's got this high-end Nikon, and every time he takes a picture, it actually eight photographs are taken, and they bracket. So he takes eight pictures, eight brackets of every picture. So that means after the photo shoot, he has to delete seven of them. Because, you know, and then you pick what is the best. So he always gets the right exposure perfectly. It's just a lot of post-shoot work.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And then if you want to put it on Facebook, you got to even do further work, because you got to compress it and everything else. We got an email from Alex. Dear Doc and Jim, is there a better way to become a Linux expert rather than just reading a book? Thanks, Jim. Well, getting a book, Jim, is probably the worst way is to learn. I just get Linux and install and start playing with it.
Huh, yeah.
I mean, half of the people have a learning method where they like to put together the bike before they read the manual. And then after they put together the bike and have a few missing pieces, they go back and read the manual to figure it out, and then the manual makes sense to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd say, you know, so whenever I'm learning new software, and I tend to be self-taught in almost everything, I tend to just get it and start playing with it. And then what I'll do is when I'll get a particular place in the, say, in that I'm working in, and I'm stuck on something, I'll go to the book, and I'll go to the index in the back, and then I'll look up the exact thing that I'm trying to work on now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll use the book more as a reference book than reading it cover to cover. So having a reference book is good.
You don't seem to retain it that way. It's when you use it instantly that it makes a click, right?
That's right. When you learning by doing is the way to retain things.
Well, that's the way you teach at Stratford, right?
That's the way we teach at Stratford. Yeah, and I'm gonna cover some of our teaching techniques at Stratford later in the show, because it's You know, I've been doing training all week this week, and so I do a lot of faculty development, and so I've done faculty development in Egypt. I've done it in India. Got some of the universities in India. Mubarak was still in power. His Ministry of Education brought us over to do faculty development there for some of the. And I've been in the Ministry of Education down in Jamaica has brought us down there to do faculty development. And they're also going to bring me back to Kurdistan to do faculty development. So this is actually sort of my passion. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to talk a bit about that later in the show.
Okay.
What was I talking about?
You were talking about Linux.
Is there a better way to learn Linux? Yeah, and you can download Linux. It's free, and you can download a free version of Linux and just install it. Now, if you install a new operating system, your old operating system is gone, and if you only have one computer, I would recommend that you download a free version of VMware, and then what you could do is you could then create a virtual machine in using VMware and install Linux in the virtual machine, and then that would allow you to have the Linux operating system installed on your computer, and you wouldn't throw away your other operating system, which might be that's how we teach it at Stratford. We've got all virtual machines so people can play around with their virtual machine, and we don't constantly have to redo all the hard drives. We got an email from Leslie in Oakton. Dear Tech Talk, we just shifted our time by 1 hour because of daylight savings time. Well, Leslie, you're a little late.
Yeah, just a tad. She's on real mountain time, huh?
I don't know where she's located. This must be
some outpost someplace near the Ohio people, perhaps.
Could be. I have two atomic clocks that were now supposed to automatically change time when the time shifts. One changed when the time shifted, and the other did not. What can I do to make them both work the same way? Love the show. Thanks, Leslie and Oakton. Well, okay, Leslie, you're going to have to sort of, you know, get with the daylight savings. If she just noticed this. I mean,
It's been months. It's almost time to shift back. I think I just leave the clocks alone for now.
Okay, first of all, Leslie, you do not have atomic clocks. Okay, there's no atomic energy source.
There's not like a plutonium fuel rod in your clock or anything like that?
Your clocks are connected to the atomic time standard that's run by NIST. That's the standards organization run by the U.S. government, NIST. And so there's an atomic clock where they're looking, and the atomic clock is able to maintain time with extreme accuracy, and they have the atomic clock standard out in Colorado. Then what they do, they send out that data to around the United States and also all clocks can set their time according to that atomic clock standard. Now they have a radio tower out in Fort Collins, Colorado, WWVB. Now, WWVB broadcasts on a frequency of 60 kilohertz, and your clock has a 60 kilohertz receiver, and it receives the signal from WWVB. Now, that low frequency, though, see, this is transmitted at Fort Collins.
Mm-hmm.
The low frequency in the day may not get to your clock, because actually the radio waves bounce off the atmosphere at night.
Right.
And so the low-frequency radio waves travel further at night. That's also true with AM radio.
Exactly. That's how you hear far-off AM stations
at night. And so you really are only going to get the time change signal to your clocks at night. That's typically what's going to happen. The other thing is, okay, remember, Fort Collins is west. So you want to put your clocks near a window pointing west. Chances are one of your clocks was on the other side of the house near a window pointing east, and so the house was blocking the signal.
Yep.
So the clock that didn't change time as it should, just take it and put it. What I do, I've got three of these clocks in my house.
Trump Leslie because she only has two.
I know, but I want to have more atomic clocks than any of my neighbors. Sorry. It's a thing with me.
It's a sickness.
I know. So so what I do, I take the clock and I just put it on the windowsill facing west. The next morning, it's reset. So that was a great question. And many people do have this problem because the receivers are you know, these clocks, they're cheap now, and the receiver's really cheap. So it doesn't have a big antenna. It's a fairly cheap receiver.
Mm-hmm. A timely question.
Yes, it is a timely question. It is a very timely question.
File that away for October, if you would, please.
We got an email from Bernie in Waldorf, Maryland. Why isn't the time on my computer the same as it is on my self-synchronizing watch? I thought all clocks were synchronized with the same time standard. Thanks, Bernie. Well, this is the same kind of question. I got two timely emails.
Yes, you do.
Well, actually, your watch, because you have a self-synchronizing watch, your watch is connected to that same radio station in Fort Collins,
does
Bernie.
Does he have a plutonium fuel rod in his watch? Wouldn't that be dangerous?
Yeah, it would be dangerous.
Okay, so
Bernie, you do not have an atomic wristwatch.
Okay.
I'm telling you.
It's not like Dick Tracy or anything.
Your watch is connected to the radio station of Fort Collins. Now, your computer is not attached to the radio station. It's attached to a time standard, which is on the internet, and it automatically adjusts the time periodically according to whenever you want it to be adjusted. I remember in the old days when the computers would not automatically set to the time standard on the internet, your computer clock would gradually shift over time. Do you remember those days?
I was about to ask you that. Yeah, like if your computer started running slowly, your clock would run slowly as well.
Yeah, it would gradually run, especially when used to have a CMOS battery in there, and the battery gets a little low, and then it kind of slows down. Well, now you don't have to worry about that because the clock about once a week goes onto the internet and sets the standard.
Well, I've learned something new today.
So you can actually log on to you click on time, I say in Windows, and then right click on properties. You can actually request which time standard it synchronizes with.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what NIST requested, they said we would prefer that not every computer in the world synchronize to the NIST time standard because it will load it down. So each of the various software companies have their own time standard that's synchronized with NIST. So, for instance, if you have a Windows machine, by default it's set to look for the time synchronization at time.microsoft.com, and it will go to that website, and your computer will automatically synchronize. Now, for those of you that would prefer not to synchronize with Microsoft and use somebody else, you can select another time standard on the internet, and there's a link to all the time servers on NIST.gov. And it's a long website here, which it's NIST.gov, tf-cgi/servers.cgi. And what I'm going to do is it'll be posted to the Tech Talk webpage. Or the easiest thing, just Google a link to time servers.
There you go.
And it'll come directly there.
I have a question. Since you have exhausted the mailbag and is now all those letters are on the floor, and Mr. Big Mouth will have to come in and clean that up. That's part of the union rules.
Yes.
He has to clean up after us. I've noticed with my iPad.
Hold it. Excuse me.
Right.
He likes to be called Mr. Big Voice, not Mr. Big Mouth.
That was
a Freudian slip.
Yes. It was indeed. Okay, so the iPad, I noticed, when I try to charge it by plugging it into a USB port on a computer or the USB port on the car radio, it will not charge. It will draw power from that and work off of that so I don't lose battery life. However, if I want to charge this, it's got to go into a wall socket. Do you know why that is?
Well, you could get a USB that would provide power. I mean, it depends how the USB is set up.
Mm-hmm.
Some USB connections won't give you much power.
Well,
another one's will.
Does it take? I get, but this will the iPhone will charge wherever I plug it in, whatever USB. Does the iPad take more to charge than the iPhone?
That's why the iPad charger is bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever noticed that?
No, I haven't.
No, you know the iPad charger, you know, it's about this big, and the iPhone charger has got the small connector. So
really,
the
one I got was just the same cube as you get with the iPhone.
No, that's not the correct one. It's a bigger one.
Interesting.
And so the one for my iPad is bigger. And it actually has three times the current output. So if I could charge my iPad on the little iPhone charger, and it takes
forever,
four or five times longer to charge. When I use the iPad charger, it charges much faster.
That's interesting. Well, I wonder if there's a difference because I got a mini and you have a full size iPad.
Oh, you got a mini.
Yeah.
Oh. Well,
here we go. Here we go.
Yeah. Well, maybe, you know, that could be, and it came with the iPad Mini.
It came with the iPad. Yeah, it was a refurbished iPad Mini, but still, it
okay,
it doesn't.
Maybe somebody switched the charger for you.
But I got an aftermarket, a bigger charger.
Oh, this like the kind the woman got electrocuted
in
China?
I bought this at an Apple store, so it's an Apple-endorsed product.
Oh, okay.
And all I got right. A nice 10-foot long USB cord that I can use wherever I want. But anyway, yes.
The thing is, I can plug my iPhone into the car USB and it charges.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I should check whether I could plug my iPad into the car USB port. But USB ports have different power ratings.
I didn't know that.
And there are some USB ports on computers will not charge or will not provide power, and others will. So it kind of depends on the port.
Interesting. Now, the iPad battery, both Mini and I suspect yours, has a longer life than an iPhone, doesn't it? I find I can do a lot more stuff on the iPad than I can on the iPhone, and it drains.
The reason is that you've got much more area to work with, and the battery inside of both the iPad and the iPad, it's a thin double-sided capacitor, and it fills the whole. It's a thin layer, so the bigger the screen, the bigger the battery.
No kidding.
So the iPad has got even a bigger battery than the iPad Mini, iPhone is even smaller yet. So that's also why you can't really change the battery in these things.
What have we learned today? The doc has more atomic clocks than anybody.
Yes.
He also has a bigger iPad than I do. Doc, you're doing things over there than doing a classroom of the airwaves.
I'm logged on to Facebook, so you can simply go to facebook.com/techtalkonline, and I'll monitor your comments during the show. And also, we love your emails. So send us emails to techtalk@stratford.edu.
That's Tech Talk and not Tech Type.
Yeah, techtalk@stratford.edu.
And you are listening to Tech Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM, HD2. Be right back after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tysons Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. A rewarding future as a holistic caregiver or nurse practitioner. Combining the art of caring with the human science makes nursing today's breakout field. Stratford University's School of Nursing at the Tysons Corner or Woodbridge campus offers a patient-centered approach with valuable core clinical training. Stratford provides a real-world education in nursing. In fact, many of today's Stratford nursing grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're going to feature Eben Christopher Upton, as his mother liked to call him. Eben Christopher Upton is founder and trustee of the Raspberry Pi Foundation and the creator of the low-cost credit card size hacking computer designed to inspire the next generation of programmers. This is actually quite an impressive feat that Christopher Upton, or as his mother would call him, I'll call him Eben Upton, created. Mm-hmm. He was born in Leeds, England in 1978. He received a Bachelor of Arts degree in Physics and Engineering in 1999 from the University of Cambridge. He completed a diploma in computer science in 2001 from University of Cambridge. Upton received his PhD from the University of Cambridge Computer Lab in 2006. He served as director of undergraduate studies of computer science at St. John's College in Cambridge while completing his PhD. Now, when he was handling undergraduate computer science admissions there at St. John's, he came up with the idea for a cheap hobbyist computer. See, what he noticed were applicants to computer science all were working on computers, but they weren't working with them. You know, they just bought the software. They all had a new they knew how to work the software, but they really didn't know much about the computer hardware. Now, this had changed from the early days, from his early days. In his early days, he was like taking computers, hacking into them, you know, trying new things with them. So he actually learned about computer science on this little device called the BBC Micro, which was available in most schools. And you can play around with the computer, and you could install a different operating system, and you really understood the basics of what a computer was. He felt that the world needed a low-cost equivalent of that BBC Micro. So he went ahead and built the next-generation hobbyist machine, which was the machine that he would like to have if he were young again. And this is, he's a teacher at heart, mm-hmm. and he called it Raspberry Pi.
Catchy name.
It was based on the tech tradition of naming computers after fruit, like Apple. Yeah, that's the one that we really know. I mean, you know, Microsoft missed the boat. They call theirs, you know, Microsoft, you know, missed, okay, you know, Windows.
Yeah.
They should have, like, Microsoft Banana.
That was the fruit I was thinking of. I wonder where our minds are this morning.
Yeah, so let's get back to
Microsoft Coconut.
Microsoft Coconut, that's right.
That'd be a fun name for a computer.
Yeah, okay, Steve Ballmer, maybe you could work on that your last 12 months.
Probably not.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to, yeah.
No, it's cruise control probably.
I think so. Well, he designed a Raspberry Pi machine that would be his dream machine, but he couldn't find any way to produce it at a reasonable price, mm-hmm. so they just mothballed the project. And then he finished up his PhD, and then he went to work at the Cambridge, UK office of Broadcom, which is a networking company. You know, Broadcom makes all these sort of wireless chips, and they're into custom chip making, as they say. And he was technical director of ASIC architecture. These are ASIC architecture. This is a customized chip design. And Upton was instrumental in the creation of Broadcom's first microprocessor intended for multimedia applications. It was called the BCM2835. It was released in 2011. Now, the BCM2835 was a single chip that could fit in a phone that was powerful enough to include a CPU and a graphics processor. So this was was really designed for the smartphone market. Upton realized, a light went off in his head, he realized that this particular chip would be powerful enough that he could use it to drive the Raspberry Pi dream machine.
Mm-hmm.
So he and half a dozen volunteers started working, you know, in the evenings on a new version of Raspberry Pi. But the BCM2835 chip wasn't that easy to deal with. It was jammed with all kinds of tiny components, including 5 power supplies. So
wow.
Different parts of it had to operate at different voltages. Well, that makes it complicated.
When
you want to make a little small device, you got to have 5 different voltages. To keep Raspberry Pi cheap, the team wanted to build it on a single circuit board. And it appeared that they would have to build a board that had 8 stacked layers of circuitry. That was the only way. There was so much interconnection, it would have to have, they have to stack 8 layers on top of each other, and that's just expensive. So they worked to shave down the number of layers required, and they finally designed a board that only took 6 layers. And they developed a full prototype, and it was ready December 2011. This was about a little over 2 years ago. And the first board selling at the target price, $25.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Raspberry Pi, it included 5 ports, HDMI to hook the computer up to a television, a USB port to hook it up to multiple devices. It had Ethernet for data. It had an analog TV and analog stereo output, and it had an SD card slot because it would boot from SD card using, and it would boot from an SD card using a Fedora version of Linux. Now, when connected to the television set and the keyboard, it's as capable as many PC desktops, and it also plays high-definition video. Almost the instant Raspberry Pi went on sale, orders crashed the website from two vendors. He sold it through you know, third-party vendors. And the entire stock of 10,000 computers was sold in minutes.
Wow.
Upton is making more of the devices through his nonprofit Raspberry Pi Foundation. He wants to sell around 2 million devices a year in order to reach critical mass. Now, he's got a number of – you can go to Raspberry Pi, RaspberryPi.org, raspberrypi.org, and you can see the devices that he has. And that, you know, they've got a, now a Model B out that sells for $35, and they've got a Model B with 8 gigabytes of SIM already installed that sells for $40. So it's really a fairly small device, and it's quite convenient. And I'll talk more about the device after the break.
Yes, we will. And in fact, we hope you were paying attention, because you could not only learn more about this particular device, but you could win free food coming up by playing the pop quiz here on Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2. Tech Talk continues right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Technology is constantly changing. An effective IT manager must not only understand the possibilities and limitations of the technology, but also the requirements and constraints of the business world. Enhance your career today with a master's degree from Stratford University School of Computer Information Systems. Classes are offered day, evening, and weekends to match your busy schedule and are taught by experienced faculty members with industry experience. Earn your master's degree in as little as 15 months with an accelerated program in software engineering, information systems, information assurance, or telecommunications. Learn more about earning your master's degree from Stratford University at stratford.edu or call 1-800-444-0804. Disclose statements available at stratford.edu/disclosures. Stratford University, 1-800-444-0804.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
It's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now, here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Welcome back to Classroom of the Airways.
As previously established, yes.
Classroom of the Airways. This is not a radio show. This is a classroom. And when there's class, there must be an assessment. I'm sorry.
PC term for test.
Yeah, there must be a test. But this will be a pop quiz. Those of you that have short memory might not notice that we have a quiz every week. But so for those of you that can't remember week to week, this is a pop quiz.
Okay.
Earlier in the show, I was talking about Eben Christopher Upton. He, of course, the creator of the Raspberry Pi computer. Where is Eben Christopher Upton working at the present moment? And this particular company also provided the foundation chip for the Raspberry Pi.
Well, in order to play our little game, you've got to call us on your phone. It could be a landline or a mobile phone, but call us if you're from west of Leeds, England. It's 877-936-9333. Calling from east of Arbutus, Maryland, it's 877-936-9333. And, of course, everybody else around the globe could call us at 877-936-9333, the wild card line.
Or else we have an alternate solution. You could go to, you could call using Skype if you're in Oman or Kurdistan.
Right.
And you could simply go to Tech Talk Radio 1 and make that connection, and the call will be forwarded directly to the studio.
And once again, that number is 877-936-9333. So back to the Raspberry Pi.
Yeah. So the Raspberry Pi is the device of the week today. It's a, of course, that was the one created by the man who we profiled this time, Eben Christopher Upton. And it's a credit card-sized computer. It plugs into a TV and keyboard. And as I said, I would recommend now the Raspberry Pi Model B with a SIM, with an 8-gigabyte SIM card for $40. Now, you're going to need certain accessories.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, it needs a power supply. And if you want to price all these things, you have to put it in a case. You can't be carrying around a circuit board. So a case is around $6. You know, SD flash memory, if you want to get additional SD flash memory, is about $8. You get the one with 8 gigs of memory, you don't need anymore. Power supplies, $8. A USB hub, because it only has one USB port, and you probably have more USB devices, around $6. You have to get a keyboard, which is around $23. Now, if you're giving this as a gift to your child, your grandchild, I'd get a kit,
right,
a starter kit, which is available for around $100, and it includes everything that you need to start hacking or creating your own robot brain. It's there are a lot of projects, home, you know, do-it-yourself projects that people have put on the internet using the Raspberry Pi machine. This is a way to get a child interested in computer science and interested in computers. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot better than having to just play around with these video games. You can go to raspberrypi.org. This site lists the two vendors that are currently offering the devices and its accessories. You will have to plug it into a television set. So most people have got an old TV laying around without any problem. There's also a forum that's devoted to Raspberry Pi, where people talk. It's a Raspberry Pi wiki, and it's on elinux.org/Raspberry Pi board. So you can log on to there, and you can talk to other people that are working on the Raspberry Pi. It's a great, great learning device and learning tool.
Okay, we've got somebody on the line to play our game. Let's go to line two. This is Dan calling from Horse Country, Middleburg, Virginia. Good morning, Dan. How are you, sir?
Good morning,
Dan. Earlier in the show, I was talking about Eben Christopher Upton, the creator of the Raspberry Pi computer. What company was he working for that he used their chip as the basis for the Raspberry Pi?
Drum roll, please. Broadcom.
That is correct. That is correct.
And we have a winner, Dan. Thank you for playing the game. Dr. Schertz, please tell him what he's won.
You win two tickets to Fine Dining, the Escoffier Dining Room, the Karem Dining Room, either at Falls Church or at Woodbridge, Virginia.
Dan, thank you. Thank you for playing. Thank you for listening this fine summer morning. And we'll put you on hold. Andrew Mitchell, our adjunct professor for prize distribution and other fun stuff, is going to take the call. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. We'll have more of Tech Talk right after this. Please stay with us.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Budget analyst, a vice president of sales. These are today's business leaders, and a degree from Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers you a powerful path to navigate the corporate world. The School of Business Administration at Stratford University offers both bachelor's and master's degree programs for a real-world education. In fact, many of today's Stratford business grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. An executive chef at a trendy restaurant, a hotel general manager at a prestigious resort. These are the high-profile positions in the culinary arts and hospitality management industry. Get working towards your bachelor's or master's degree at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus. In fact, many of today's Stratford culinary arts and hospitality grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers, here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. JustDelete.me is a website. Right. JustDelete.me. And that can help you drop all of your online accounts. Some of us are getting too hooked on online stuff, Facebook and everything else. Mm-hmm. And they just want to, you know, drop away from the web. But going out and trying to delete all these accounts can be problematic. So developer Rob Lewis and designer Ed Poole teamed up to create what may be an indispensable resource. It's called JustDelete.me.
It's like entering the virtual witness protection program, isn't
it? That's right. Mm-hmm. And it's a directory that links you to the pages that where you can basically delete your online account. And frequently, these pages are hard to find because they don't want to let you easily drop out. But they go right there. You can click on it, and you can then and you agree that you when you log on to JustDelete.me, you get a grid which shows you direct links to all the popular web services, and it points you straight to the pages where you can deactivate the accounts. Now, they've done a lot of due diligence to figure out which services can be disconnected from painlessly and the ones that require you to actually communicate with someone to get the job done. Some of them make it really hard. And quite a few of the services do fall into that latter category.
Really?
You know, they said 10 of them won't let you kill your account without first talking to a customer service rep. Four of them include Netflix, Stream, Starbucks, and WordPress.
You can't. How about that?
You can't get out of those unless you talk to somebody.
Ugh.
Oh no! Oh, these four don't let you delete your account at all. Netflix, Stream, Starbucks, or you can't get. And then 10 other ones you can delete it, but you have to talk to someone. But If you're interested in doing that, just go to JustDelete.me. And now let's talk about Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer announces his retirement.
The guy who made the coconut computer, right?
Yeah, the man who made the coconut computer, the man who really didn't notice that the world was going to iPads, the man who didn't notice that the world was going to smartphones, the man who thought that the desktop PC was going to live forever, is Mr. Steve Ballmer. And the previous CEO of Microsoft, Bill Gates, is the man that didn't think the internet was going to make a difference. So Microsoft missed the big entry of the internet, and that's why they're so far behind with online services, and they did a pretty good job of catching up there, and then they missed the movement to the post PC age when everything is moving to laptop. So when Steve Ballmer announced his retirement, the stock price soared, and Steve Ballmer was worth $1 billion more.
No kidding.
So hopefully he's not going to kill that billion in the next 12 months because he's going to be hanging around. Now, sales analysts were quite surprised at this because they didn't expect it because Ballmer had just fired the guy who developed Windows 8, which has turned out to be a dud. And so they were saying that Vista was really a bad operating system, and then they came out with Windows 7 that was pretty good. Windows NT was quite good, and but Windows Vista was a real turkey when it sold. But it turned out if you compare the sales of Windows Vista to Windows 8, Windows Vista looks pretty good because it sold a lot more copies than Windows 8.
So they managed to do even worse this time.
Yeah, and this was supposed to be the big thing that was going to transform Microsoft Windows 8. Well, Steve Ballmer fired the guy who actually developed this, and people felt he was the heir apparent to be CEO of Microsoft. So when Steve Ballmer fired him, they thought this is Zelensky. They thought that that he was going to be there for a long time, but actually he's not. So Ballmer's 57. He succeeded Bill Gates as CEO in 2000. He'll stay on until a successor's found. Gates, who's now chairman of the board, will be part of a small committee tasked with finding a successor. Devices chief Julie Larson Green is tipped as the most obvious internal candidate. I mean, it would make sense a devices person because they've got to move into devices.
Mm-hmm.
But many analysts urged Microsoft to look for an outsider to shake things up. Ballmer first met Gates in 1973 when they shared a dormitory hall at Harvard. You know, Bill Gates famously dropped out of Harvard.
Yeah.
I wonder whether Ballmer graduated or whether he dropped. I don't know. I'm gonna have to go. Maybe I'll feature him next week.
That's a good idea.
I'll get the inside scoop on him. Now, under Ballmer, the company developed successful products like Windows XP, the Xbox 360, and it grew to be worth $78 billion, and it now employs more than 100,000 people. It has more than a billion users worldwide, and it still remains extremely profitable. Over the past decade, however, its share prices have stagnated, mm-hmm. in contrast to three companies that have just taken off: Apple, Google, and Amazon. Once Microsoft was the world's most valuable company, but now that it's lost more than half of its market value, it's not in that ranking. Critics accused Ballmer of failing to anticipate the explosive growth of tablets and smartphones and the decline of personal computers. And that, of course, I think is right on the money, and that is really central to his failure. Some, though not all, are appeased by the 22% jump in share price this year after the company started developing and selling its own tablet-style computer. Now, last month, Ballmer announced sweeping reorganization that focuses on more hardware and is designed to make the company nimbler. It appears that he's trying to organize Microsoft the way that Apple is organized, which would make a certain amount of sense.
Mm-hmm.
Ballmer's personal wealth is around $15.2 billion, which includes 4% of Microsoft stock. He was born in Detroit. He was the son of a Ford Motor Company manager.
Interesting. Didn't know that.
He studied applied mathematics and economics at Harvard. So he graduated from Harvard. Then he worked at Procter & Gamble, and he later dropped out of Stanford's business school, mm-hmm. to join Microsoft. So Steve Ballmer at least got a bachelor's degree. I mean, Bill Gates was a dropout,
yeah.
of Harvard, and actually so was Steve Jobs. So there we go. That's let's talk a little bit about teaching techniques.
Okay.
We got a few minutes here.
Yep.
I can't do too much about that. One thing we do at Stratford, we try to teach to the four learning styles. You know, there are four learning styles that correspond to the four temperaments. Half the learners, as I was saying, have to want to put together the bike before they read the manual. So we give people a chance to get hands-on, get in there, play around with stuff, because that's how people learn. And then after they have played around, well, then we can go back and look at the theory. Now, there's another 25% of that, by the way, if you're into Myers-Briggs, these people are SPs, if you're into Myers-Briggs. Now, the other temperament, about 25% of the people are actually there by the book. They want to know all the facts. They want to get everything laid out. So they need structure in the organization. And so that group, SPs, we give them the structure that they're like. And if the structure, then they can learn. Then they would be SJs. And then about 10% of the people, actually want to know why. Why is this important? They're the NFs. So we have to give them the why, the reason behind what everything is important. And unless you give them the why, they won't get it. And the last 5% are NTs. These are people who really won't follow any kind of rule. They just like to make up their own rules. So you put group work, you give them very challenging projects, and if you put together a class that accommodates all four learning styles, you can truly be student-centric on how you deliver your education. And that's why at Stratford we have such a high retention rate. And on our graduate programs, you know, above 90%, undergraduate programs nearly 80%. So there you go. The show is over, and I'll tell you, we love Tech Talk, and we'd like you to check out the Tech Talk webpage, techtalkonline.com, and check out the podcast.
Please do. And if you missed any of the show, would like to hear it over again, we will replay the program at 4 o'clock today here on Federal News Radio. We'll see you next week.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. and federalnewsradio.com.
And it's going to be a nice day today. Sunny skies, highs near 80 degrees this afternoon. Mostly clear tonight, low near 60. Nationals baseball on the air later on today. The Nationals in Kansas City against the Royals. The game coverage starts at 6:30. First pitch at 7:05 right here on Federal News Radio. Outside our studios in Northwest, it is sunny and it is 67 degrees at 10 a.m.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or